In this episode, we wait out there for part one of our discussion with Matt Grayeski from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Matt grew up hunting and fishing on his local lakes and on trips to his family's cabin in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan with his parents and four siblings. It was in the UP that he learned to fish for steelhead and fell in love with river fishing for trout. But as Matt grew older, he began to appreciate the challenges of inland lake fishing more and more. In particular, he found a passion for streamer fishing and muskies, developing new tactics and helping to form a community of passionate anglers that shared his desire to catch the fish he dubs rule breakers. Matt also began to dive deep into fly tying and fly design, and sells his flies through his website, adaptivefly.com. In part one of our conversation, we discuss breaking down inland lake muskie habitat. Welcome to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Shemchuk. At Wade Out There, we believe fly fishing is special, but not elite, and that anyone can become a great fly fisher if they are willing to go, learn, and teach. Join me as I talk with other fly fishermen and women about their unique journeys into fly fishing, the rivers they fish, and the tactics and philosophies they practice. For those who can never leave the river in their hearts, this podcast is dedicated to helping you make the memories that keep us all coming back to Wade Out There. Welcome, Matt. Thanks for being on the Wade Out There podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. You look a little different than I was expecting. I was expecting the long hair.
I've got the same
haircut as me, man, all the way down.
Throws people off.
I know. Well, and then I talked to your brother Eric, and he recommended that you'd be somebody that might be interested in talking on the show. But then I realized, oh, I've got all these other people that have recommended him too, but that was for Matt and Eric. And I've only talked to Eric. And then, so when Eric reminded me, like, oh yeah, okay. And then I looked back in my notes. I'm like, oh yeah, some of these are for Matt, but I just got the, anyway, man, needless to say, I'm excited to talk to you. And it should be fun. Your brother was a hoot, and I'm excited to get some of your perspective on some of these stories that he told, maybe, because he has the biased opinion.
Right. And you started in the right order. He's the older one, so you got to start there and work. There's actually a third brother a lot of people aren't really aware of because he's not like involved in the industry. We have a younger brother, Mark. And we're all super close in age.
I'm going to put him on the list if he fly fishes.
I'm not sure if this isn't really his thing, but.
Well, what if he's got you and Eric all together? Because I think I could do all of it, and that would be fun.
Yeah,
the whole show would just be stories. Like, right. Okay, what's the one where the guy messed up the most? Like, or where's the one where who caught the biggest fish or something like that? That'd be fun.
There's a whole part in the Brothers Brown film where we're at our cabin and we're just talking and Rob just started recording, you know, because it was like at the end of the day, after the float, after we ate, we're just like sitting around drinking beer. And next thing you know, he just starts recording and we didn't even really realize he was recording. And then he told us he was, and the conversation like stopped and he's like, no, don't do that.
What's that? I'm just kidding. I'm not recording.
Yeah.
No, oh, well, maybe we'll talk him into it. And then there's a sister too, right?
There is, yes. She's not much for more hunting and fishing. She's a golfer.
She's not into it. It might be fun to have her too, though, so she could poke fun at you the whole time.
Yeah, she definitely would.
Okay, well, that's it for a future episode. The three Grayeski brothers. I would really enjoy doing that.
Right on.
What was the thing you were talking about that you guys were recording, or you mentioned it there? I'm not super familiar.
We did a film on the fly fishing film tour. I can't even tell you how long ago it was. Could have even been 10 years ago, where the short version is Anglers of the Asable does a ton to protect the Asable River system from mining and fracking and those type of things that would damage the ecosystem of the river. Rusty Gates did a ton to raise money for it. When he passed away, they were looking for ways to make money. So they wanted to do what was like essentially a smaller version of the Pebble Mine, where people would donate money, even if they've never been to the Asable, would ever go there. So they wanted to do a film on the film tour to start to get the work, like get interest in the Asable River around the country. And they Rob Thompson, who was the filmmaker, was like, well, I need a story. Like, I don't want to just talk about the river. And he's like, so I have an idea. I know of these three brothers that have been fishing there since they were kids. And so that's how it started. We actually said no to Rob for almost 2 years because
really?
That's not why we fish and do what we do, right? So it was a little weird for us to, because if you've seen a lot of films on the film tour, there's a lot of people that really enjoy and want to be in front of the camera and they turn it up a little, you know. And that's
I don't really know enough about. I mean, I just know I've seen a little bit. I've gotten a little taste. It's not.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly extremely artistic, like, well done.
There is.
I mean, it's beautiful, like some of the footage and stuff, but I know what you're saying. I guess I'm with you on that. I get it. But that's cool that you did it. Maybe we can link to that in the show notes so people can check it out. And
So they did like the entire film was called The River, and I think it's almost 3 hours long. And like the portion that they did that they kind of separated out called The Brothers Brown, I think is like 41 minutes or something. And then there was like the shortened condensed film tour version.
But, why is it The Brothers Brown? What's the
So Rob is a big music fan, and so there's a band, the Brown Brothers.
Okay.
A duo, I assume.
Okay.
And he, you know, we're fishing for brown trout on the Isabel River, and just The Brothers Brown was just what he came up with.
And it just
stuck. Yeah.
That's cool. All right. To be continued. We'll let people check that out. We can have that in the show notes, can't we? Like a link to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll let people check that out. And then I'm going to talk to Mark. I'm going to get Mark. Maybe I'll talk to your sister and I'll get Mark and we'll do Brothers Brown 2 or something like, okay. Well, that's cool. So the Isabel though, that was, you know, all your guys's growing up. I know that Eric had talked about this. You guys went up there a bunch and he talked about this a little bit, but was it like a summer cabin that you went to all summer long, like cottaging, you know, like in Canada, they go cottaging. Like, was it something like all summer you were up there, or was it just, you know, that was kind of our weekly vacations in the summer? How did that work?
It was both. Like, there was a time in the summer after, like, we played baseball when we were younger, like after that was done before school started, that we would go for like 2 to 3 weeks. My mom and my brothers and my sister and my dad would come up like on weekends, but during hunting season, like during whitetail season, it was every Friday after school, you know, we were up there until like, you know, roughly Thanksgiving. And then we close the cabin for the winter. And then usually sometime around like Easter weekend or before turkey season started, we open it back up. And then it's like, we're there almost every weekend, it seemed like, for sure every holiday weekend, you know, Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, and then.
Wow, that's really cool. So that's awesome.
We were up there a lot.
So you grew up eating a ton of venison.
Eating a lot of venison, rabbit, squirrel, fish.
Okay.
Like, as a family of six, I don't remember my mom buying meat when we were a kid.
You know? Yeah, when I grew up, I was similar. We ate so much deer meat. It was crazy. And it was every year we would drive out to Montana. I would take a week off of school. So I missed the whole week. And it was always like, okay, this only works if you get good grades, you know? And I don't know if that was really, I was probably more motivated at that time by like trying to go fly airplanes for the Air Force and for hunting season. But yeah, I mean, it was venison all the time. Venison roast, and that was good.
Yeah,
I think
I'm still that way. You know, my son hunts, my daughter hunts, used to hunt a little bit, but between the two of us, you know, we're a 4 or 5 deer a year type family to make it. Hopefully,
that'll get it down, that'll get it done.
Yeah.
You got to provide sustenance for your family, man.
Right. Yeah. And it is like, you know, it's hard to get teenagers like focus on the outdoors. And he's living on the lake has been huge. Like, my son goes out all the time.
Goes out doing what? So I know that you are in Grand Rapids and now you're on a lake in that area. So your son is going out hunting and fishing, or both?
Both. So like on fishing, like on the lake, when we first moved here, he did The Michigan DNR has like a course online that you have to complete if you're under the age of 16 to drive a boat with that has a 30 horse or higher motor on it. So he spent like 8 hours doing that, and he goes out, and we're fortunate that they stock tiger muskies in the lake. So that's, for us, that's pretty enjoyable. There's a lot of largemouth, a lot of pike. Yeah. Yeah. He just takes the boat out and off he goes.
That's cool, man. Good for you for making the move. I mean, that reminds me of, it is hard to get kids in the outdoors with mm-hmm. just kind of the way society is moving, or it can be, I guess.
Yes.
My wife and I, we've got a 9-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl. And we moved to Utah almost 3 years ago. And that was a big motivator for us. It was probably mm-hmm. top 3 reasons why we came out here is because we wanted to raise our kids in the outdoors. And it's not that we wouldn't been able to do that in Missouri.
Sure.
I mean, certainly in Missouri, that's where I learned about like tree stands and archery hunting and turkey hunting and ducks and all. I mean, I got mm-hmm. real Bass Pro-y, or yeah. that's a way. Yeah. I got into it, man.
Yeah.
Deeks and all kinds of stuff, but mm-hmm. It's different. And also in the summertime, it was tough out there to be in the woods because of ticks and chiggers and
sure,
stuff.
And
so,
mosquitoes.
Yeah, but I guess I'm just saying, good for you making the move, like doing something like that. I think having come out here, our children are in the outdoors a lot more year round. So it's kind of a like strategic move.
Sure.
For us, it was. Was it like that for you guys? Did you guys think about that, or was it just like a bonus?
Yeah, no, it was like a more of a family thing. So my daughter is in college now, before she was in college and with she played travel across one summer. My son played travel across for, I think he's in his 7th year. It consumes a lot of your summers. And it was hard to, our cabin is 3-hour drive away. We used to do some camping trips and it was just hard to schedule all that stuff it's only 2 miles from where we lived before, but we weren't on the lake and an opportunity came up and now, whether it's 2 hours in the evening, we go out on the lake almost every single evening, in the summer, just to have that create that opportunity to be able to happen more often.
Yeah. So now that becomes like your normal. You don't have to go away for it. You're not doing the trips. The whole thing is the thing. Like, yes. I don't have to take my son on a ton of fly fishing trips or hunting trips necessarily from Missouri, or if I want to take him in the mountains, we're already in the mountains.
Yeah, right.
Not everybody can do that. I understand, but I just think that when you have the opportunity and you see that and you realize like, oh, this might be good for the way I want my kids to see the world. Good for you, man.
Yeah,
I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
So now we're going to talk about inland lake fishing, because mm-hmm. that's kind of where you fish and how you fish a lot now, and you're on a lake. And I know you love to streamer fish as well, but can you talk a little bit about, from the time you're on the El Sable, your transition into fly fishing, and then from more river fishing to more lake fishing, and why that happened for you, or why you kind of changed in the way that you fish, or
sure.
a little bit about that journey?
Yeah. So growing up on Lake St. Clair, like all of our fishing was lake fishing. We would go to the western end of the Upper Peninsula every year for 7 to 10 days. And that would be the only opportunity we'd have to fish like creeks and rivers and fish for trout. So as a kid, I loved that. I don't know if it was because of just the small amounts I got to do it. I mean, the fish are beautiful, fishing for brook trout and little UP streams and stuff like that. So I really loved and enjoyed that. So as I got to be a little bit older, and especially once Eric could drive, we would do a lot of river fishing because we could just go do it on our own. And I did a ton of river fishing, like I wouldn't say exclusively, but probably 90% of my fishing for 10 years through my like teens into my early 20s was trout and steelhead fishing. I'm trying to think of the way to say this. In Michigan, there's a lot of drama when it comes to fishing on the rivers. We have a lot of fishermen.
Okay, you can just let it go, man. But if you want, I understand your desire to keep it cool. I like that. But
I think most people would agree with. I don't think I'm saying anything shocking.
Okay,
but you know, in our rivers, we have.
Is it because of like crowds, like people, or is it because of like laws and rules, or is it just like?
It's mostly the number of people doing it, because we have a lot of public water in Michigan, okay. But we also have a shit ton of outdoorsmen and outdoors women, right? So like we have, and when it comes to like archery, we have more deer hunters than in the other state. So it's like everyone's just packed in, and you have, when you have like steelhead fishing on some of our larger rivers, you know, you can use a jet boat, so you can run up, you can run down, and
everybody has an opinion about that. Like
everyone,
that's the easy stuff. Sure. If I had enough money to have a jet boat, then I would blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
And information just travels so much faster now. So we're used to have periods of fishing before it got crowded. Well, there would just be drama. You know, people would, then when social media, it even really started back in the forums, like people would send you a message and be like, how's the fishing on this river, Ben? Or how's this? And if you didn't answer them, you're an asshole. If you did, people are mad at you because you're giving out information. And there was just like, we had, you know, Eric always was just enamored with muskies when we were a kid and growing up on Lake St. Clair. You know, they were around in the UP, you know, they were around in the places we fished. And Mark and I were always like, I was big. Trout was like my big thing. Mark was kind of just go with the flow, go with whatever, probably being the youngest brother. And Eric started fly fishing for muskies on Lake St. Clair. And then Mark and myself and a friend of ours, Jay Carey, started doing some research, looking through stocking records of where they were available in inland lakes around us. And we started doing that. And then we started, as much as we love the fish, instantly there's like no drama. There's like nobody else fly fishing for them. The guys that are gear fishing are interested in what we're doing. They're super polite to us. And they would literally tell us like, we just moved 3 fish over there. Why don't you guys see if you can get one on a fly, you know? So the river fishing just became, it just wasn't enjoyable anymore because of the drama. And that's just not for my brothers and I. Like, I know you talked to Eric, and I think most people that know us know we try to stay away from all of that. It's just, so then the more we started to fish for muskie, the more and more we just really loved it anyways. So that was kind of the push towards back to lake fishing. And then going from, one of the things I always loved about river fishing, especially here in Michigan, is, you know, you got to be able to read the water. You can't see the fish just because of the color of the water, depth of the river. So you're, every spot you go to, right, it's like a, you know, somewhat of a puzzle, and you're trying to piece it together where the fish would be sitting. And lakes are like that every single time you go out, and it changes often multiple times in a day. So that going out there, having to use your electronic, learn how to use them, learn to piece together each individual lake of, in this water temperature, this time of year, this is where the bait is. That's where the muskies are going to be before the sun gets on the water. Once the sun gets on the water, you learn they move to here, you know, or in this pre-front condition, they like to push to the weed edge. So you just, it's just a constant puzzle. And like we talked about before you started recording, like I get bored easily. So that constant, and that was sometimes with rivers. Once you really learn a river, it's like, you could probably go 20 years later and it's like, oh, this drift right here, that's where a steelhead's going to sit, you know? And there's nothing wrong with that. I just like that constant change, that constant having to figure it out.
I think it's interesting that one of the big reasons why you switched kind of more to lake fishing and that type of thing was the drama. I don't know if I just don't remember from Eric's conversation, but I don't know. I just wasn't expecting that. And I think it's super interesting as well that the gear guys were very welcoming. And I wonder, you know, how many of them like got into fly fishing because of that or learned something from you guys or you learned from them. Was there things in those relationships that like you guys fed off each other or were you not, did you not interact enough to have that kind of learning going on?
No. So muskie fly fishing in Michigan, especially going back 10, 12 years ago, very, very few people were doing it. It was years. I couldn't even tell you how many years before I saw somebody else doing it. So the only friends I had in muskie fishing that I got to know mostly through fishing a lot of the lakes in the area were guys that were gear guys. So
it's so funny that you guys are fly fishing. Like, I'm just tired of all this. Like, why don't we just go where nobody's doing this, and then we can just be on our own? I think that's awesome.
And that was like, you know, when we started out, a lot of our fishing outside of Lake St. Clair, which is obviously its own sort of animal, the UP, you go fishing in the UP and you drive down a two track and you're not likely to see one other car. And if you do see another car, you don't stop because somebody else is already fishing there versus, say, steelhead fishing in Michigan and driving around and trying to find an access where there's only 10 cars, you know? And it's like, oh, this one's not that busy. There's only 10 cars here. So it was just, we're fishing for more than just the fish. There's no place I can think of where I really want to go that it's worth dealing with things that are going to make my day less enjoyable to catch a fish. I'd rather catch no fish someplace trying to just figure, I'm not saying like something new no one's done, but something, a lake I haven't been to, try to figure that out, then go somewhere where I can just catch a bunch of fish.
Yeah, I had a friend when I was in Missouri. Me and him were partners on an intramural bass fishing league through the base out there. And honestly, I had done a little bit in the past, but like very little bass fishing before I went to Missouri. But now I'm like thrust into it. I mean, there's rules and we're away. I mean, you know,
it's not just fishing anymore.
Right. Well, and mostly I did, he used to do it with his father. He's a guy I flew with, so he's in the squadron. He's older than me, gentlemen. I don't know. I don't want to call him out, but he was, you know, he flew in Gulf War I stealth fighters. Like, dude is cool. Like, his motto, he said their motto was, "Hope this shit works." That was like the squadron motto.
I feel like that's how I fish.
Yeah. Anyway, this guy, I love him, but he was way into bass fishing, and just the way that you're describing the lake, that's the kind of stuff that I remember from bass fishing that I just had no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, I had no clue, and he could really break down a lake and understand it in the way that I would look at a river and break it down. And he knew different temperatures and cloud conditions. And I mean, it's very, very similar, you know, they're water creatures, they're fish, right? So, I guess, going back to it, what were some of the challenges that you saw, I guess, early on in fly fishing, and how did that kind of change as you moved into the inland lake game?
Yeah. So I think for us growing up, and Eric may have touched on this as well, like my dad exposed us to like all techniques of fishing. You know, having a family of six, like on a like single income, which was normal in the 80s. 1980s for any of the kids out there.
The Reagan
back
era.
Back in the 1900s. You know, one of the biggest things my dad taught us, whether it was intentional or not, was that you never accept that the fish just aren't biting. Because a lot of the times, while my parents thoroughly enjoyed the outdoors, and as they got older, you know, we weren't living in the house, they didn't need to keep fish all the time. But we're also trying to get food. So I've met a lot of people throughout my life that it's like, oh, it's just not happening today, right? They go out and they do the same thing that they did before when it did work, and they don't like adjust to that. So my dad was always, just absorbed it. He was always trying to figure it out if we weren't catching anything. But he instilled that in us. And I think just by what he did every day we were on the water, but he also, you know, we learned how to bait fish. We learned how to fish with lures. We learned how to, and fly fishing became the thing my dad would break out for fun. So we'd have all six of us in a,
it's like this outlier kind of we're going to do this other kind of weird thing.
And he did a little bit of it in the Upper Peninsula when we were kids. We wouldn't be with him, but he would go with someone and they would teach. I still remember, as a kid, he caught his first big brown on a Royal Coachman. And I still remember that when he told us that when we were younger. But we'd have all six of us in a canoe fishing like backwaters of Lake St. Clair, and there'd be a lot of largemouth, and we'd be fishing. And then when it would get, the sun would hit the trees, he'd break out the fly rod with a popper on it. And a lot of times if he hooked one, he'd let us take turns bringing it in.
Yeah, that's the best.
Yeah. But with six of us packed in the canoe, he definitely,
I was just going to say one second, hold on, let's go. Yeah. We're going to rewind. Six of us in the canoe. Yeah. You got to expand on that. Sounds like you're already going to do that.
My dad was always in the back seat. My mom was always in the middle. And then we'd be two. So then there would be, I actually don't remember the length of the canoe. I just remember there were two other sections besides the front seat that had bars in between. Right.
Okay.
And two of us would sit on tackle boxes side by side. And it was usually always Mark and I, who is my younger brother, and then Eric being the oldest, so probably the biggest, would be next to my sister, who was the smallest. And we were so my mom and dad in the two front seats, then two of us side by side. I'm sure it was a complete shit show.
Yeah.
I just remember my dad having to untangle lines all the time, but my dad all the time. Back, he'd be able to cast a fly rod off the one side. And those are my first memories of seeing a fly rod, of being around fly fishing. Then as we got to be, I couldn't even say how old we were. I remember, and again, my dad was like, he had a couple fly rods he'd picked up at a garage sale. The lines were shit, which pretty much everything, a lot of stuff was back then. The rod was a Berkeley fly rod, I remember, so I don't even know when they stopped making them. And then it was rubber spiders and fishing for bluegills in ponds. Like, that was like our first experience of trying to do it ourselves. And it was I remember being like, the first time I did it, like, I want to do more of this. I
think you were hooked.
Whether it was different.
Yeah.
Whether it was the challenge of like literally just trying to figure out the casting and, you know, going back in a time of pre-internet, it was just figure things out on your own, which I love to do. And I still do. In some ways I still live under a rock. Like I don't really consume much fly fishing, like, knowledge. I just like to go out and learn it. I don't know whether it's my attention span of trying to, you know, watch a long video or read a book. I'd just rather go out and try to wing it. And so I'm sure there's some things I'm not great at. But I also think it teaches you more on how to adjust to things in different situations when you learn it on your own.
A couple things about that. I want to talk more about adjusting to things and some of that kind of trying to be, you know, creating, being active, fishing actively and always trying to figure it out. Cause I'm a big believer in that too. And I think most people are that are out there really trying to progress, is this concept of the fish are always biting, you know, I think about that a lot now, especially the more that I'm surrounded with and having conversations with all these different fly fishers that have all this success and different areas and different things. Just the more you do it, the more you realize this is not a fish problem. This is a Jason problem. This is like, fish are eating, dude. Like, somebody else could come here and do good.
Right.
But there is a balance, right? Sometimes maybe, you know, you just can't figure it out or whatever, sure. You're moving on. But I got to say, the hero of that story is your father. I mean, holy smokes, man. Teaching you all that and having the patience to have everybody in there.
Yeah.
That's a feat. I would like to say I could do something like that, but I don't know that I could.
I don't know if I could either. He was a hero, is a good way of putting it, man. Like, I think a big part of it was my mom loved doing it so much.
Right.
So, you know,
we're all in. Everybody's in.
Yeah. I'm going to tell a story that I don't think you could do nowadays without like Child Protective Services being called. But we used to fish this section of this river that led to a waterfall. Not like a massive waterfall, but not one you want to go over in a canoe, right?
Okay.
Big rock.
Not with six
stuff.
People in it, yeah, not so two adults and four minors.
Yeah. So the system my dad came up with, and now keep in mind, so my dad was a helicopter mechanic and gunner in Vietnam. And right.
I knew I liked this guy. Yeah.
A lot of what you might understand is being a helicopter gunner mechanic, if you get shot down, getting that machine back up in the air is for your first priority if you can. So you're making things work in any way possible, right? I remember he had this, so he passed away from what they believe was his exposure to Agent Orange and resulting in cancer. But up until he died, I remember he had this big coil of wire that he brought home from Vietnam that was like, you wrap it around anything, and if you pulled it tight, it would just take the shape of whatever. So he's like, we'd literally use this wire to put parts of an engine back together to try to get this thing back up in the air, right? So if there was a problem, it was never like, well, we're not going to figure this out. It was like, how are we going to? Because that's what he learned, right? As I'm sure you're very well aware. So the system he came up with is my mom would have a rope tied to her. It would go down the back of our life jacket, out the bottom, then down my brother, then my sister, then tied to my dad. So if the canoe tips, we're all still attached. One of us isn't going to float downstream and go down this waterfall, right?
Okay. Okay. We're all going to drown together, yeah. Or we're all going to survive together. That's also very Vietnam helicopter mechanic, like kind of mindset. Yeah. We're all in this together, fellas.
And I would
like
say
this is
likely there wasn't a spot that wasn't that deep of a river in the UP. Yeah. So like if the canoe, the main thing was to prevent someone from one of the kids from drifting downstream. So we're all tied together. We have life jackets on, right? So this is the type of person my dad was. It's like, oh, my mom really wants to fish this stretch of river. We have these four little kids with us. Like, how do we make it work? And so he would figure it out. That's how he approached everything, And so, like I said, like with fishing, it was like, he just never, so we have such limited time to fish, most of us. And when we do, the chances of that being a good day are slim, like meaning weather patterns, perfect waters, temperature, everything's perfect to where the fish are just going crazy, right?
And you have a skill level too. Everybody's got a different skill level to inject into that. And I think that's, there's statistics are part of it. And just some days, even if you're, the best of the best, everybody has slow days.
Yeah.
Right. But if somebody has just an average day, for somebody who's not as skilled, then that's maybe a bad day or terrible day.
And that's what what we learned from my dad and what we took into fishing was, so if most days you're going to go fish on average are going to be like neutral or maybe a little bit above neutral, right? So if you can catch them when they're like that or when they're passive, then when it's good to great, now it goes from like, say, you can take a 20 fish day to a 30 or 40 fish day, because you figured it out when you should have caught none and you caught five, type of a thing. So, and that was, that's just how he approached every single time we went fishing. It was just, he never stopped trying to figure it out.
That's awesome, man. And I think it's great that he shared all that with you and it's rubbed off a little bit in the way that you approach fishing. He sounds like a wonderful man.
And, he was.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I guess that's all I'll say, but that's cool. What a great American
he was.
Let's talk a little bit about this inland fishing in the lakes. What were some of the challenges that you had when you kind of transitioned into more of an inland fisherman, what was something that you were surprised by or you had to really kind of overcome when you kind of turned more towards the inland lake game, which is kind of where we talked about before the show, where you kind of spend most of your time these days.
Yeah. So the inland lakes, so we grew up fishing them as kids and I felt like I understood lakes pretty well. What I didn't understand was inland lake muskies. And muskies are hard enough to catch on their own. And then probably the dumbest thing you could do is then try to fly fish for them if you want to catch one, right?
I didn't want to say this earlier, but I was like,
against ourselves.
Maybe the gear guys were happy to give you information because they're like, they're not going to catch anything.
Yeah, they'd always ask, like, do you guys ever catch anything? You know, do you ever get one? You know, and they thought it was, the ones that would stop and talk to us, anyways, the ones that thought we were idiots probably didn't bother talking to us. And I got to know, I have people I still have that are friends today that I met on the water because they were just kind of like, are you guys fishing for muskies? You know? So it was learning, you know, bass, pike, any type of panfish, like walleye, the typical things we see in our lakes here. I feel like I could go to a lake I've never been to before and I would be able to figure it out in that day for sure. Muskies were more so than any other fish I fished. In the same day, they could be in 3 feet of water and then suspended over 70 feet of water in the same day.
What is it about the species that you think, or let me put it this way, what is it that you are doing to try and figure it out that works for maybe other species, but then you apply that to muskie and you're like, eh. Cause I'm interested also in fishing inland lakes for other species besides muskie. So there must be some like not formula, but kind of like habit pattern or kind of method that you apply to a lake or a new lake. Mm-hmm. I'm curious around how you approach that, not just for muskies, but for the other species, because then I can understand like, all right, if that's the plan, then how does that not apply or not work, I guess?
So for muskies, the thing that changed what we were doing and made us way more consistent is understanding where the food is. So most of our fish, like say largemouth bass during very specific times of the year, almost anywhere in a certain region of Michigan, bass are going to be in the same general areas in any given lake, right? Because that's where they spend their summers. That's where they still find food. Muskies, what they eat is different for the most part than any other inland lake species outside of maybe pike. But even then, pike really, really spend a lot of their time around weeds. It's just a matter of knowing what time of year and what depth, where what weeds they prefer, where's new weed growth, that type of thing. Last weeds do not die off. But muskies will often relate to nothing other than the food. So that's where, I mean, I've caught muskies 7 feet, 7-8 feet down over 43 feet of water. You know, there's no other species that I'm going to catch there. The only other thing that's there is the food that they prefer, whether that's Cisco's, whether that could be schools of crappie, you know, and while like it is one of those things you do start to learn in some lakes, the crappie are there because of the substrate at the bottom of the lake. And that's where insects are hatching from and they're making their way to the surface and the bluegills the crappie are intercepting them at, you know, 10 feet below the surface or 5 feet below the surface, but the bass aren't going to be there. The crappie or the walleye aren't going to be there. The pike probably aren't going to be there. Cause again, bluegills is a big part of the forage for a lot of our inland lakes here, and muskies will eat them, but it's not really that sustainable for them. So the food that the muskies prefer moves throughout the day. It doesn't sit still, right? Versus say in rivers, like if they have a heavy diet of, say, suckers are going to remain in certain holes in the river, you know, for long periods of time, maybe all year. There are suckers in a specific hole 365 days a year. But in lakes, the food moves. And muskies don't really seek cover. You know, you do get like in rivers or some inland lakes like in the UP where you have some structure like down trees and stuff like that, that they might relate to. But they're not as much like ambush like a pike. Like, so they don't always relate to anything. At least in the, just specifically referring to the inland lakes in the lower peninsula of Michigan, there are some times where they are on weeds. But I think it's more to do with it's not cover, it's weeds create oxygen. Bait relates to that oxygen. Muskies need oxygen. So there could be deep weed growth that pops up in 16 feet of water and everything else surrounding that is 40 feet of water. And they'll relate to that hump with weeds. It's usually adjacent to food. So food is suspended out in that deeper water. Sometimes it relates to the edge of the weeds. Sometimes it doesn't. They're always in the vicinity of food. So it's always learning the lake and where is the forage and where does it go. And it, like I said, it could change from it was sunny to start the day. Now it's cloudy. Maybe that bait was pushed to the bottom. Now the clouds come out, the bait suspends. So like, are you fishing your fly below where the muskies are? You know, muskies usually don't seem that interested in the bait when it's on the bottom because it's not doing anything. You know, you can find underwater footage of a muskie chilling with a school of suckers and they do nothing until one of the suckers decides to freak out, you know? And then all of a sudden it's like that instinct kicks in and it eats. It could be another muskie that stirs up that stirs up a school of ciscos that then another muskie decides to engage because there's all this feeding activity going on. So it's just never the same. Like I could do this for 2 hours and talk to you about how much, you know, all
how hard they are,
and you know, sure. But that's the biggest thing is like, you can never go out and just pound shorelines or pound weed edges every single day and think that that's your best chance to catch a muskie. Some days that works, but some days it doesn't.
Yeah, that's something I remember from bass fishing. It was like kind of you'd figure out the temperature and time of year, and then it was kind of like, this is sort of where they are.
Yeah, and you could go to the next lake and it would probably be the same if it's the same time of year, same temperature, similar weeds.
Yeah. And then you would kind of do a lot of the same stuff for that species of fish, like, and you just move to different sections or different areas, and certain spots might be hotter than others, but
sure,
it was kind of, this is our plan, this is where we're going. Mm-hmm. There was still like, maybe they're not on the shore, maybe they're suspended or things like that. We would change things like that from time to time.
Yeah. But
it sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that when you go to a lake, you're trying to figure out where the fish, typically for most species of fish, you have an idea just based on habitually the time of year and maybe the weather, like this is where they kind of like to be. And muskies are, they don't follow those rules.
There's like, there are some rules, but like I wrote a small online or article years ago, like that was like titled like rule breakers, because just when you think there are rules that apply to muskie that are like a good starting point, but I can't tell you how many times. And I think what's like kind of spawned that article was my younger brother and I, Mark and I were fishing a lake and it was a second day of a cold front. So bluebird skies, high pressure, we shouldn't catch anything. And we caught 3, you know, but other times you're out there in perfect conditions, you know, exactly where they should be and you catch none, you know? So it was like, and I know that can happen with any species, but one of the great things about muskies is you're often fishing for one bite, you know, like you don't go bass fishing for one bite, right? So like muskies, you're often fishing for one bite. So it's you're just always working towards that. Anything more than one is a bonus. You know?
Do you ever catch other species? I mean, you're going for musky and you're like, this is a musky day, but like, I don't know, you end up catching something else, or is it there's such a predator fish and the flies are so unique that that doesn't happen?
It does. It a lot of times it depends on the body of water. So say on the lake that I live on, it's not uncommon for me to catch pike if I'm fishing for tiger muskies. Lake St. Clair, you can definitely catch large smallmouth. Same thing here. Like, a largemouth bass, as you know, will eat whatever can fit in its mouth, you know, and I've caught plenty of 4 or 5 pound largemouth on 12 inch flies because they can fit it in their mouth. Sometimes it's a certain time of year where they kind of overlap where they're at.
What's something that you learned recently or maybe relearned, a lesson learned about inland fishing that kind of surprised you or you weren't expecting, or you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. Like something that came up recently for you.
So I'd say like the The lake that I live on was a little bit of a learning curve because it's a relatively shallow lake. So most of our inland lakes, you know, are going to have depths of at least 20 feet. The lake that I live on, I think the deepest spot is 14 feet. So in a sense, the lake is almost like a giant flat. And there were definitely times of the year that I thought I would be able to find them suspended in the areas that get to be 12 to 14 feet deep. But this lake doesn't develop a thermocline like most of our inland lakes do. So the bait, the forage fish, didn't set up the way it did in other lakes. So I had to kind of relearn a sort of flat, relatively structureless lake. Why I started finding the muskies in the same spots consistently and not for the same reasons that I found them in other lakes. And then their morning spots were different than their midday spots. And then their evening spots started to overlap with their morning spots a little bit. And it did take some time. Usually in the summer in the inland lakes here, if you find muskies in a certain area, they're relatively close to that same area. But here on this particular lake, I could find them a substantial distance away, but they're in those same spots every day in the middle of the day, then the evening and it or mornings. And once I give my son Miles a lot of credit because he spent a lot more mornings out there than I did. And when he started to figure out some of that stuff, it kind of made the other pieces click. And then we became way more consistent. But I thought it was good though, because I thought it was going to be easier than it was.
Which is not what we're after, right? You already said, like, you want to problem solve.
Yeah.
You like the mystery. Like solving problems. So that was a pleasant surprise for you, I guess.
It was.
Did you go into it like, look at this shallow lake?
Oh, I thought it was, I don't know if humbled is a good word, because I don't feel like I approach it like I always have it figured out, but it was harder than I thought it was going to be. I had to put in more time, which, like you said, ultimately was a good thing. And now there's a level of satisfaction of knowing what I know now. So our lake doesn't have a lot of, I think there's 70 something houses on the lake. My son and I definitely fish the lake more than anyone else, but they'll do this thing where they figure out how many muskies were caught every year. And last year there was two, and they're like, how'd you guys do? And I was like, we caught more than two. it's kind of fun in that the strategy and the techniques that go behind it, because a lot of people go out there and just fish for them and they'll run into them occasionally, which is great. They're super excited about it and it's awesome. But there's some part of me that enjoys that it's not always the same and that I'm just not lucking into one, if that makes sense.
Well, yes, that makes a lot of sense. It sounds like what you're saying is you have a barometer for your skill set, right? Because if they are, you know, the fish with no rules or the rule breakers, right? You're saying that they're really hard to catch and I can't figure, they don't follow rules and I can't find out where they're at. And, you know, there's one individual might be like, so it's just the luck of the draw. You're just lucky if you catch them, right? So great job, Matt. Pat yourself on the back. You caught some muskie. You got lucky, whatever. But if there's like a barometer or there's somebody else fishing for them and they're not being as successful, now you can be like, well, yes, there's luck in fishing for sure. But you're comparing yourself. I'm not saying you're comparing yourself, but like you have something to go off of. Like, okay, how good am I doing here? Like, does that make sense?
It does. If they're all catching a ton and I'm not, then I know that I'm sucking at something, you know?
Right.
And what am I doing wrong? You know, what do I have to figure out? And the thing that I love about fishing is that, and kind of what we talked about with the Brothers Brown and saying no to something like that, is if no one else lived on this lake, I would do the exact same things I do, fishing for the exact same fish. And I really don't I really don't give a shit if someone's impressed by that or not. You know, I would do that if I was the last person on Earth.
I understand. You know? And there's a concept of the fish are always biting that like feeds into that, right? Yeah. Like I'm going to be doing it regardless. I'm going to be problem solving regardless. Mm-hmm. But it is nice to know that like you're finding some successes. And with a fish that's so unpredictable, it's helpful to have a barometer. It's one of the reasons that I like to fish with a guide from time to time, sure, is just to be like, hey man, how am I doing?
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, give me some tips. Like, how's, you have anything for my cast? Like, I'm an open book. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I got a thick skin. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll take any and all inputs, you know. Yeah. You don't have to like instruct me all day, but one of the reasons I'm here is just to kind of get a gauge on like how I could be better, right, or how I'm doing. And, I don't think that takes away from the specialness of the sport. I think it just adds to the desire to kind of progress.
Yes.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know,
yes,
people, I want to get better at fly fishing. That's not like a competitive kind of, ooh, I want to catch more fish than all the other people,
right,
in the lake, because then I can tell Jason on the podcast that I'm, you know, like, that's not what's happening.
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying, man.
And I fish for myself, and through my lifetime and with my brothers too, because like I told you, a lot of times people think we're the same person, so we're kind of a three-headed monster, and it's like, oh, you guys catch all these big trout, and it's like, well, there's three of us, but they just they will assign like each one of us caught that same amount, but like I, like you said, that barometer.
Oh, yeah. It's like times like three. So if you catch like two fish, it's really
a little bit of a mirage in that people and our success. It's because people will be like, how many muskies have you and your brothers caught? I'm like, I don't know, hundreds. And they're like, hundreds. I'm like, well, you know, some of us have caught more than others, and it doesn't, you know, we haven't all caught, you know, well, Eric's caught hundreds for sure. But like my barometer is just with myself. And if I ever got to a point where I'm like, there's nothing else here to learn, I wouldn't stop fly fishing. I just wouldn't do it nearly as often. The draw to me is constantly like, I'm getting up sometimes at 6 a.m. in the summer to fish a lake that I live on because I'm like, I got to figure them out in the morning, you know? I don't really want to get up at that time to go fish a lake I have, you know, access to all year round. But if I felt like I went out a couple mornings and I didn't accomplish as much as I wanted to, then I'm just already up at, it's 5 a.m. and I'm like, oh, I'm already awake thinking about it, you know? But if I went out and just crushed them, I'm not eager to get up the next day and go do it again.
Sure. It's the same reason I'll go fishing on like a rainy day when the water's probably too high or like not really great. I'm like, I want to, you know, have a idea about what to do here. Yeah. And you got to go. I mean, you got to go if you want to, if you want to learn about how to catch fish, you got to go fishing. Right.
For sure.
So I'm curious around the physicality of not just muskie, but inland lake fishing. I mean, I'm just imagining just hauling these big flies around all day. Can you talk just briefly about the gear and maybe a little bit more about like any tips you have for maintaining kind of without throwing out your shoulder or your back or like, I mean, it's an all day event. I mean, it could be, I guess it doesn't have to be, but it just seems like a lot of that. And if somebody was getting into this or maybe even just throwing lots of streamers, like what have you observed that's helpful for making the transition into big streamers, lake fishing, stuff like that?
Yeah. So I will say like we first started fishing big streamers for trout, like brown trout, you know, we're ideally seeking out brown trout, like over 24 inches. And they're just a predator at that point. They're really, you know, a lot of similarities to their behaviors. And so that's when we started throwing like 6-7 inch flies for trout. And when you're doing it in a river and you're either rowing or you're fishing, those are way more exhausting to me than fishing a lake, because in a river, it's like, you're always trying to hit that next spot and that next spot's always coming up. So everything's fast paced. It's like you get a cast in, you want to quick hit that log, you want to quick hit that drop off. But in a lake, you control the pace. So if you haven't thrown big flies before, that is going to be exhausting. But if you've thrown, I find fishing for muskie less physically exhausting than streamer fishing for trout. just because of the pace. Now, I will say also this, a big thing is it's a large number. I don't even know if I want to put a number on it. Most musky flies have way too much material on them. I'm talking about twice as much material as necessary. So that is exhausting yourself. And I think a lot of things people don't consider is you're stripping that fly more than you're casting it, right? Like your fly should be in the water way more than it is in the air. And how hard that fly is to pull, like retrieve, that plays a big factor in your exhaustion. People always talk about the casting. And honestly, if a fly is bad to cast, it's probably going to be bad to strip or manipulate in the water. But you can really minimize with technique the amount of material you use to gain a profile and an action that you want. And then it makes it so much easier. That's what I would say. If you're going to get into musky fishing or pike fishing or any inland lake fishing where you're fishing larger flies, like over 7 inches, is try to see if you can find information or learn how to create profile with the least amount of materials. That's ultimately what you're trying to accomplish. And there are ways to do it, but I think what's hard is places like Instagram. So I can't tell you how many times when people see my flies in person, they're like, it's a lot more sparse than I thought it was, because it doesn't come through in a photo. So I think you see photos and you think, I got to add all of this bucktail, I got to add all of this synthetic, or the head has to be this big, and it doesn't. Now, there are a lot of people that do, and those can work, but you are going to exhaust yourself. You're going to make it harder than it needs to be. So that was kind of a, I don't know if that was a long answer.
That was a great answer. It was an unexpected answer. And I did want to ask you about your fly tying. So I think that's a good segue. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. You can learn more about some of the topics we discussed in today's episode show notes. For more fly fishing ideas, stories, and artwork, check out my blog and online gallery at wadeoutthere.com. If you want to make Wade Out There a part of your own fly fishing journey, please subscribe and share. Until next time, Wade Out There.